Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Courtney here with a special offer just for you. My new book is coming out in April. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It's all about grief and sorrow and the ways that birds and birding can bring us to a place of hope. It's a book of faith. It's a book of humor. We would love to give you a 20% discount. You can use this code, IVPPOD20. That's IVPPOD20. That code will give you 20% off and free shipping anywhere in the US when you order from ivpress.com. Pick up your copy of Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief today. Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. Today on our show, we have some birding royalty. Ken Kaufman is here to talk about his new book, The Birds That Audubon Missed. Ken is the author of 13 books about birds and nature. This will be his 14th. It comes out in May. He's spent his life immersed in the natural world, working as a writer, illustrator, lecturer, and occasional tour leader. He comes to us from Ohio. Welcome, Ken.
Well, thanks, Courtney. It's great to be here.
You know, I live here in Southern California, and most folks are jealous of our weather, but in March and April, I am jealous of you for living in Ohio. What do you see this time of year, birdwise?
Right. Well, actually, you know, many people are jealous of us during the spring because here in northwestern Ohio, there's a fabulous spring migration. We're right up against the edge of Lake Erie, and birds are moving north in spring. And they move north sort of on a broad front, but they get to the edge of the lake and they stop, think about it before they continue northward. So we get these concentrations of birds from the end of February through the end of May, with a peak in late April and early May. And at that point, the warblers, you know, these wonderful little colorful, brightly colored, hyperactive, tiny little birds that hide among the leaves, the warblers. There are more than three dozen species that come through here, and it's just sort of a wonderland of these little things at the peak of migration. We refer to it as the warbler capital of the world, and people who have been here and experienced it are inclined to agree.
It's going to be amazing. I'm living vicariously through all my Ohio birder friends at this time of year. I wish you many warblers, Ken.
Well, you should come visit too.
I should. I keep telling my husband. He's like, this is our whole retirement plan, right? We're just going to be on a lifelong birding tour. It's like, absolutely. As soon as I don't have to go to work during the day, this is my plan. So Ken, your new book that's coming out, I was blessed to get this early copy to prepare for the podcast, and I am just loving your book. I've learned so much about the history of bird study, which is a topic I did not think that much about before reading this. It was the Wild West for a bit there. Tell us a little bit about what inspired the book, The Birds That Audubon Missed.
Right. Well, I've always had an interest in history in general, you know, reading world history and American history, but I hadn't thought that much about the early history of bird study on this continent. And just a few years ago, I've been a field editor for National Audubon Society for quite a few years. And a few years ago, they were putting a complete gallery of John James Audubon's bird paintings onto their website and accompanying it with a lot of information. And as part of my work, I was reviewing all of this and fact-checking all of it and ran across the fact that there were some fairly common eastern birds that Audubon never encountered. You know, he could certainly be excused for leaving out some of the Western birds because he never got as far west as the Rocky Mountains. This was the early 1800s and travel was a challenge. But there's some birds that are really common in the eastern U.S. and Canada that he should have seen, that he never ran across. So once I noticed that, I started looking into it, and it led me into all these little byways of discovery, reading about John James Audubon in the early 1800s and his rival, Alexander Wilson, and then all these other characters who were running around at that time. Charles Bonaparte, who was the nephew of Napoleon, and Thomas Nuttall, who was really more of a botanist, but who sort of moonlighted as a bird person. John Townsend, George Ord, there were all these people and the sort of prickly relations between all of them. They were sort of friends part of the time, but also competitors. And so it was really an interesting time. And I got so fascinated with it that I eventually thought, well, you know, I have to write a book about this.
It's such a fascinating journey into these bits of history that I was unfamiliar with. And one of the things that surprised me was there was just a lot of bad behavior. Like you said, you know, they're not getting along. They're fabricating things that they've seen. And, you know, the tale of the Lincoln Sparrow, and how upon further study, it seemed like Audubon made up that entire thing. What story surprised you most in your research for this book?
It's hard to pin down one particular story that surprised me the most, but I had sort of a shift in viewpoint. I mean, John James Audubon was this amazing artist. His bird portraits, they're magnificent, and he's still considered to be one of the great bird artists of all time. And so as a kid, I had really admired his work and so on. There were some things that he wrote about that didn't seem to make sense. And historians had tried to explain, you know, how was he so mistaken about thinking that there was this gigantic eagle called the Bird of Washington that, you know, somehow he made this mistake. The more and more I got into it, the more obvious it became that he made up a lot of things, that Audubon was constantly making things up and trying to compensate for the fact that he didn't have any scientific training and trying to claim that he knew more about every bird than Alexander Wilson did. Just all this, doing all this compensating and just making things up. And I eventually flipped to this new attitude of rather than thinking, okay, there must be some explanation for how he made this mistake, to just assuming that, you know, you can't believe anything that he wrote unless there's some independent verification of it. So really a fascinating character. He was a great storyteller, but unfortunately he continued just telling stories when he was supposed to be describing his scientific discoveries.
I kept thinking of P.T. Barnum, like... He's the P.T. Barnum of the birding world. Like, you'll never believe this man is 9 feet tall, when really the man is, you know, 6'11", but that was very tall for the day, but he wasn't 9 feet tall.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great comparison. The P.T. Barnum of the birding world, that would be, I'm going to quote you on that.
Steal it for your next book. I loved that you included the illustration of the carbonated warbler, right? Which seems like a bird he possibly just made up out of whole cloth.
That's right. Yeah, that was to begin with, it's a great name, carbonated warbler. You expect these little bubbles rising from it. He called it that because it had black markings, like it was marked with carbon. But he may have seen some bird that looked a little bit like his painting of the carbonated warbler. But when you really get in and analyze the painting, it's obvious that it wasn't based on any specimen. Most of his paintings were, he had the dead bird right in front of him so he could copy details from it. But with the carbonated warbler, all of these, it doesn't work as a bird. It's not a real bird. So he was doing it either from memory or from imagination. And, you know, for more than a century, people scientists were saying, well, the Great Audubon, there must have been something there. And they were trying to explain what the carbonated warbler was. And now we just assume, well, you know, it was a product of imagination.
I appreciate that you treat Audubon and all of these other figures as the complex historical people they were. They are not saints, but they're not fully sinners either. They're complicated people like each one of us, like every birder we've ever met who, you know, sometimes in our desire to see that rare thing, think we've seen something that we really haven't. And you treat them with a lot of gentleness without, you know, glossing over some of these choices that they made that, you know, baffled scientists for 1,000 years. How do you think about portraying these characters? How do you do them such justice as you've done in this book? Because I guess they're not characters, right? They're people. They're human.
Yeah. Well, I've been working really hard the last couple of years to try to increase the amount of empathy that I have for everyone. I just think there's not enough of that in the world. And so I'm really working harder to try to understand the viewpoints of people with whom I disagree and trying to empathize with people in different situations. And so, you know, you're right. None of those early explorers were saints, but they weren't devils either. And they all had some really admirable qualities. I mean, Audubon, there are a lot of bad things you can say about him. He bought and sold slaves. He committed scientific fraud. But at the same time, he worked incredibly hard. He had all kinds of bad luck, and he kept just working so hard and coming back from it. He was a very... he was a very faithful husband. He was a good father to his sons. He was very loyal to his friends. There are a lot of great things you can say about him, and I think that's true for everyone. Anyone who has really accomplished great things has probably done some terrible things also. And I just think that we shouldn't look at the world in such a high contrast way. Hmm. We should be able to look at other people and recognize the good and the bad in them, and just, you know, love the good parts and, you know, acknowledge the rest.
Throughout the book, you weave in your own story and anecdotes from your own birding life and birding with friends with these historical accounts. And one of the ones that really was touching to me is you go to the Texas shore, you're looking for a fallout with your friend Victor, and you face this question from someone who says, one of my friends gave up birding because all of the population declines. Birding just became sad for her. She couldn't do it anymore. And so, you know, she poses the question to you and Victor, what should we do? You know, how do we go on? And say a little bit about Victor's answer and what it taught you, because it was so meaningful to me as someone who, the more I get into birding, the more I realize it puts me in touch with grief. You know, I notice when there are fewer birds in my yard, and that makes me sad. And I hear about, you know, just recently Flacco the owl in New York City who hit a window, and the whole birding community is grieving the death of this Eurasian eagle owl. And I think there's the temptation to just recoil from it then. I want to do happier things. I want to just watch TV. That's easier for me. Tell us about Victor's answer in walking into that tension. And what do you do with that tension?
Right. Yeah. Well, this was, I was leading these birding workshops with my friend Victor Emmanuel, and he's been birding since he was a little kid, and he's seen the migration on the upper Texas coast, you know, every year for the last, you know, more than half a century. And he's led birding tours all over the world. He's got great expertise, but he's still got this sort of childlike sense of joy. And, you know, let some brightly colored bird pop up in front of him, and you know that he's seen it a million times, but he's still like, oh wow. And I just love that sense of wonder that he holds on to. And so yes, this person at our workshop asked, you know, what do you do? Do you focus on what we've lost, or do you focus on what we still have? And Victor just said, we can do both. I mean, he was very direct about it. We can do both. We can celebrate what we still have. He said, we can celebrate what we still have, and we'll appreciate it more if we acknowledge what we've lost. And I just thought that was wonderful. That was quite a few years ago, but I've remembered it ever since. It's I've been birding for a long time too, and some birds have become much scarcer. Some birds that I've seen in other countries are extinct now, and that's a sad thing. But there's still wonders around us. Every time we go outdoors, we're surrounded by just amazing bird life and other aspects of nature. And I think that's always going to be worth celebrating.
Where are you finding hope in the birding world these days? We hear a lot of the sad stories, but where are you seeing flickers of things going well?
There are actually a lot of hopeful stories. When I was a teenager in the 1970s, we thought we were going to lose birds like the osprey and the peregrine falcon, the brown pelican, bald eagle. These birds were rapidly declining toward extinction. We thought the Kirtland's warbler was going to disappear. We thought the whooping crane was going to disappear. All of those birds are doing much better now. There's been a great rebound in the numbers of brown pelicans, ospreys, bald eagles. And so it proves that conservation efforts really can work. So we're seeing just great increases in the numbers of some of these birds. That's certainly a sign of hope. And something else I find really hopeful is I get opportunities to work with groups of young birders. For example, there's an Ohio Young Birders Club. My wife, Kimberly, she helped to found it a number of years ago. It's this group of teenage birders. And every year, there's more kids coming along. And there's an annual conference where all the presentations are given by these teenagers. It's not a bunch of adults lecturing to the kids. It's the young people getting up and giving the presentations, and they're always great. And it's you look at this collection of youngsters out there, and they're really diverse, and they're really passionate, really smart, and you think, wow, the future is in good hands. There are young birders out there who are really going to do great things.
Those must be so fun.
Oh, they are. You should come to that too. It's that's in the fall, so you would miss the spring migration. But you really ought to come out for the Young Birders Conference.
I would love that. I'm working with my kids. You want to let your kids pursue their own interests, but I do things like leave birding magazines and birding books out, just open to interesting pages. And I'm hopeful that at least one of the three is going to stick. So maybe we'll send a young birder to you before too long. I love that you started your book with this story of how you just loved nature as a young child and were so excited that you had discovered a bird until your teacher shot you down. And you kind of had this idea of wonder, and your teacher was like, you did not discover that bird. Someone else discovered that bird. To discover something, you have to be the first person to ever see it. How can we foster wonder? And, whether it's in children or it's in newbie birders, I think sometimes the temptation is to tell them what they don't know, like your teacher did to you. But you held on to that nugget of wonder, and you've chased it now for all of these decades. How can we nurture and give people permission to follow that wonder? And what's kept you following it all this time?
I think it's important to encourage that sense of wonder. When people have been birding a relatively short time, like maybe 10 years or something, and I started birding when I was 6, and by the time I was 21, I knew everything. I knew absolutely everything, and I was you know, sometimes tempted to say, you know, people would see their first cardinal, you know, which actually, you know, you don't get to see cardinals in Southern California. They're these brilliant red birds with a big red crest and beautiful song. Someone would see their first cardinal and they'd be excited and I'd, you know, oh, that's just a cardinal. But everything, you know, even the most common birds, if you slow down and look at them and listen to them, they're wonderful and amazing and they do remarkable things. And I just think the beginners have more fun. So it's really worthwhile to hold on to the sense of being a beginner. The saddest person, I think, is a person who thinks they know everything. But yeah, when I was a kid, I had this idea that, you know, I'd see something for the first time and, hey, I discovered this bird. You know, it's called a common grackle, and here it is in this book. Adults were saying, well, you know, you didn't discover it. You know, it's already in this book here. You didn't discover it. But I continue to think that when you see something for the first time, it is a discovery. And it can be a rediscovery when you see it again in a new light. When we're talking about these pioneers running around Eastern North America in the early 1800s, people like Alexander Wilson and John James Audubon discovering things, probably all the birds that they discovered had been well known at one time to the indigenous people who lived in the area. You know, it was the wilderness they were exploring had been inhabited for thousands of years, and there were some really advanced civilizations. It's true that by the early 1800s, a lot of those civilizations had broken down because of disease and war and so on. And so Audubon didn't have the chance to learn directly from indigenous peoples there. A century earlier, an Englishman named Mark Catesby was running around what's now the Carolinas, and he was able to learn directly from Cherokee and Chickasaw warriors who let him go along with their hunting parties, and they could tell him about the birds because they already knew all these birds. But by the time formal ornithology texts were being written in the early 1800s, a lot of that knowledge had been lost. So these guys had to go out there and stumble around in the woods and rediscover these things. So it's a lot of it is rediscovery. Things we learn, the things we learned for the first time, there's a very good chance they were already known somewhere.
But not by us. And that matters
not by
too.
Us, yeah. So it is a discovery, you know? It's you go out in the morning and see something you've never seen before. That's a discovery, and it's something that ought to be celebrated.
I'm going to remember this every time we go to the grocery store parking lot. My daughter lights up over a crow that's eating trash, you know? And I'm like, let's get in, let's buy our groceries. But like, pause for a moment. That's a beautiful thing.
It really is, yeah.
Maybe not the trash, but the crow. The crow is a beautiful thing.
Now, crows are really super intelligent birds. It's amazing what they're able to do. This is sort of a spoiler alert, but I'm starting to look at some of these birds like crows and parrots that apparently have much greater mental capacities than what we've given them credit for in the past. And that, you know, there are really other intelligences out there that we need to acknowledge.
Absolutely. I love a crow. I think sometimes the ordinary birds, like you may have seen 1,000 crows, but have you seen this crow? This particular crow in this particular parking lot is a new thing.
It is.
So you tell the story in the book of your many hitchhiking adventures, some legal, some illegal.
Right.
And you write that you'd made it to almost all 50 states by the time you turned 40, except one. Tell us about that one. Why did it take you so long? And what did you find there?
That's right. Yeah. Of the 50 states, by the time I was 20 years old, I'd been to 48 of them. I had hitchhiked up the Alaska Highway to Alaska. I'd hitchhiked back and forth, you know, Maine, California, and Washington, Florida, and so on. And then a few years later, I stopped over in Hawaii on a flight to somewhere. So that was 49 states. And finally, number 50, when I was approaching 40 years old, number 50 for me was the state of Kentucky. And it's, you know, it's a wonderful state. It was very important in the early history of bird study, but I was doing all my hitchhiking on the interstate highways, on the main ones where it was strictly illegal. And the main routes I followed, none of them happened to go through Kentucky. So I just hadn't visited there until I was like 39 years old. Now I've been back a bunch of times. It's a wonderful state.
Good birding in Kentucky.
Absolutely, yeah. And Henderson, Kentucky is very important because Audubon lived there for almost 10 years when it was probably the period of his life that he came closest to actually having a normal life, just running a store and living with his wife and his young children. And he was, you know, on the side, he was going out looking at birds and practicing his drawing, but he wasn't doing anything exceptionally crazy during that time. So Henderson, Kentucky still claims Audubon. They've got a museum there. They've got statues up around town. He's very much a favorite son there.
You saved the best for last.
That's
your,
right.
In your journey of all the states.
Right. Yeah. That's what I could say. Yeah. It's like dessert.
I love that your book is not just words, but illustrations. You include a lot of Audubon's illustrations, but also a lot of your own. And I think to be a lover of birds in a scientific way is different than to be a lover of birds in an artistic way. And you encompass both of these things. And also, as you know, in your work as a bird historian, but for someone who's interested in getting into drawing birds, you are very, very gracious. You know, you say people think that artists just have these forms in their minds and can sit down and draw them, but really everyone, it helps everyone to work from a model, to work from a photo, to work from an illustration, you know, Audubon and all his dead birds. We try not to do that now. But for someone who wants to get started in drawing birds, what advice would you give to them?
My main advice to someone who wants to try drawing birds is to just loosen up and not worry about what the first results look like. For a while, I had the opportunity to go into second grade classrooms here in Oak Harbor, Ohio, with a friend who was working at the wildlife refuge here. And she was doing education work. And we would go into these second grade classrooms and I would teach these courses on sketching birds. And these second graders, they did great. You know, they were not self-conscious about it. So they would just start drawing. It's much harder for adults because, you know, look at the results and worry about, you know, they don't look exactly perfect. So the advice I'd give is just to jump in. And birds move around a lot, so sketching them from life is a challenge. There's nothing wrong with, you know, just finding a photograph and just starting to work from that. You can work with a series of ovals. The bird's body shape is always sort of an egg shape, and you can sort of get that right and put sort of a circle where the head would be and a line for where the edge of the wing would be, a line for the tail, the position of the legs, just a few little lines. You can get sort of the basic down and then start filling in details. It's it can be really rewarding. If you're copying a photo, you don't want to go ahead and make like a completed painting out of it and try to sell it, you know, unless it's your own photograph, because there's, you know, there are things like copyright laws. But for just practicing, you know, you can find hundreds of thousands of bird photographs online and just sketch away. One thing I found helpful is to sketch in ballpoint pen. so you can't erase it. That mm-hmm. helps loosen up because you don't worry about going back and fixing it because you can't. So just get that incline down there. And if it looks terrible, start over, cross it out. The hardest thing is just to loosen up and create. And even if the finished drawing is terrible, the process of doing it helps you to see things more. I mean, to me, that's the most valuable part of it. Just it makes you see things that you wouldn't see otherwise.
I've noticed that. I do on Twitter sometimes I call it badly drawn birds, which just gives me permission to sketch badly. But even in those, you know, when I'm like, what does a kingfisher look like? And what is the head shape? And, you know, even with these little cartoony sketches, it has made me a better birder because in order to draw something, in order to recreate something, even if, you know, it's just a silly sketch, you have to be able to see some of those details in your mind. And, you know, I've got my field guide open and I'm studying and the advice to loosen up is good advice. I just label mine as badly drawn, so it takes all the pressure off. But you do such a beautiful job in this book of including not just your finished, polished, beautiful illustrations, but some sketches as well. So we can kind of see the process and we can see your thinking and we can see that, you know, it goes from rough to finished. And there's permission there, I think, to be a little messy with it at first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, being messy is definitely a part of it. It's an essential part. You know, Audubon's earliest bird paintings were awful. You know, he wasn't born with the ability to do perfect paintings. He did a lot of really terrible drawings before he got to the stage of doing great artwork. And you know, so that's a part of it.
There's something about hitting adulthood where I think we feel like if we're not great at something already or we're not experts, then we shouldn't try. We shouldn't open our mouths. But like you said, working with the second graders, they're in this posture of learning already. You know, they don't know all the multiplication. They're learning that too. And when we can put ourselves in that place of lifelong learning, I was at one of those wine and painting nights with a bunch of my girlfriends and, you know, everyone's having a glass of wine and we're painting something silly, but everyone was so stressed out. Like, this isn't going to be good enough. I can't hang it up. And I was like, what if we just, you know, enjoy the process? No one's, you know, this isn't going to go in a museum. We're all here to have fun. None of us is a professional artist. I think we've lost that, but I think birding is one of those practices that has brought me back to this place of whimsy and this place of wonder. And I so loved that your book, even though it's very historical and the science is all wonderful, there's whimsy in your book as well. I mean, you tell funny stories of hitchhiking is not really legal. Maybe I shouldn't have done it, but I saw a lot of birds. You know, you have this kind of wink, wink, nod, nod that I think opens up permission for people to just go out there and explore a bit. Are you a natural born explorer? You started birding at age 6. Has this always been part of your story?
I guess so. I was interested in nature before the age of 6. We didn't have a television in the house because my parents thought it was a bad influence. But there were a lot of books around, so I'd look at books, and I was really interested in big nature. Bears and dinosaurs and elephants. But we were living in the suburbs in Indiana, and we didn't have any of those things. And so, you know, eventually I thought, well, I'll look at these birds here. There's so much to explore and so much to learn. And I've been, I've been studying birds all my life, which has been a very, very long time. But if I start to feel conceited about how I know all this, you know, I know all these facts about birds, all I have to do is look at some other aspect of natural history, like, you know, ferns or insects. I mean, that, you know, then you realize, okay, yeah, you know, you're still a beginner. You know nothing about this. I know nothing about fishes. That's, you know, there are more than twice as many kinds of fishes in the world as there are birds, and I know nothing about them. So, you know, natural history is good that way. If you know, it's good at taking you down a peg, and you can stay in that stage of being a perpetual beginner. And I think that's important. Being like approaching the world as if you're a child, you know. I really think, you know, young children want to learn the names of things. And I've tried to hold on to that, wanting to know the names of things, even if they're, you know, even if it's just some stupid plant, you know, and not a bird. I still want to know what it's called. And I just really recommend that to everyone. Don't grow up. You know, growing up is highly overrated.
That is a good word. That's really true. Beginners have more fun. Kids have more fun. We should lean into that. So I'm about to hit you with the three hardest questions of the podcast. Are you ready?
We'll find out.
Buckle up. Okay. Where is your favorite place to go birding?
That is a hard question.
Today, where is your favorite? It can change tomorrow.
Every place is wonderful. A week ago, we were in Jamaica. My wife and I were visiting a friend in Jamaica and getting out birding there. And I'd been there before. But, you know, in those moments, that was the most wonderful place in the world to go birding. There are close to 30 kinds of birds in Jamaica that are found nowhere else in the world. It's amazing. You find this with islands. These really special things that are not found anywhere else. There's a hummingbird called the streamer tail. The little and the male is brilliant green, has a bright red beak, and these long streaming tail feathers. And it's amazing. So last week, my favorite place to go birding was a little side road out of Stewarttown in Jamaica. This week, my favorite place to go birding is the Western Lake Erie Marshes here in Ohio, because it's March and the waterfowl migration is going on. There are all these ducks pouring into the area. I was out yesterday and had hundreds of northern pintails. And, you know, the northern pintail is such a beautiful, beautiful, elegant duck. Just the classic long outline and the long tail and so graceful in flight. And you see pintails and you think, you know, this is like the perfect bird. Today it's the Western Lake Erie Marshes. Who knows what it would be tomorrow?
That was going to be my second question, was what's your favorite local birding patch? But it sounds like that one's right nearby.
Yeah, I'm very lucky to live here. I've lived various places and they've all been good for birding. But here in northwestern Ohio in spring, it's pretty remarkable. So does that mean I've survived two of the three difficult questions?
You have. You're doing great. You're doing great. Nice. But this one might take you down. I don't know. It's hard for people. What is your favorite bird today?
It's different every day. My favorite bird, in general, it's whatever bird I'm looking at that moment. Let's just say today my favorite bird is something called the white-throated sparrow, which is very common and widespread in eastern North America, and there are smaller numbers that winter out west. But the white-throated sparrow is kind of remarkable because it has four genders. And that sounds like something I'd be making up, but it's got two color morphs. The stripes on the head can be either white or tan. And for a long time, there was confusion about that. They thought it was, well, that's male and female, or it's adult and young. But no, it's two different color morphs. And they've got that color for life. And there are behavioral differences between the color morphs so that the white-striped birds, whether they're male or female, they're more aggressive than the tan-striped birds. And so males, whether they're white-striped or tan-striped, sing a lot. White-striped females sing too, but tan-striped females generally don't. Mated pairs of white-throated sparrows are almost always one of each, one tan-striped and one white-striped, but it can be, you know, either gender, either sex. And when you get a pair of white-striped birds that mate up, they usually don't succeed in raising young because they're fighting all the time. When it's two tan-striped birds that form a pair, they usually don't succeed in raising young because they're so timid that they can't even defend their territory. It's totally remarkable. It's a common bird. And it was just within the last few decades that studies in Canada turned up the fact that the bird has this astounding behavior that so far isn't known in any other bird in the world. And you pursue this, you start getting into looking at bird species, and like every bird has something about it that's totally remarkable. And to me, that, you know, it's like miracles. I really believe that we're surrounded by miracles all the time. And I lose patience with people who, you know, are just sort of waiting for some miracle to happen when they could go outside or look out the window and see miracles happening right there. You know, I could pick like any other bird and tell you, you know, not because I'm so smart or anything, but just, you know, because every bird has something about it that's utterly remarkable. But the final reason why the white-throated sparrow is my favorite bird today is that it has this beautiful song where it sings, "Oh, sweet Kimberly, Kimberly, Kimberly." And that's my wife's name, you know, just by coincidence.
I love that. That's beautiful. She and the bird are both in cahoots.
That's true, yeah. Robert Frost wrote a poem about Kimberly once. It was called "Never Again Would Bird Song Be the Same." You can look it up. It's a beautiful poem.
I will. We like birds and poetry here on the podcast. That's why we call it The Thing with Feathers, with thanks and apologies to Emily Dickinson.
Which is a wonderful title. I love the attitude that you bring to the podcast. And I'm looking forward to you. You've got a book coming out soon.
I do have a book coming out called "Looking Up: A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief."
But I'm very much looking forward to that.
It comes out just a couple weeks before your book does, so they'll be out there in the world together.
Right, so we're like brother and sister in terms of books. That's great.
I'll take it. Well, Ken, thank you so much for both your time and the gift of your wisdom on the show, but also for all the beautiful books you have put out into the world. They've encouraged me as a new birding enthusiast, and I know they've encouraged so many others. How can folks find your book, and how can they connect with you?
I've got a Facebook page called Ken Kaufman, Author and Artist, to distinguish me from all the other Ken Kaufmans out there.
Perfect. We'll link to that.
Ken with two N's is the tricky part.
I know that kind of makes you unique among all the Ken Kaufmans.
But at least in the top five, you know.
Well, Ken, we will link to both your book and your Facebook page in the show notes so that folks can find it. And I just really highly recommend it. It was such a delightful journey. I was telling Ken before we hit the record button, I'm only 2/3 of the way through because I was speeding through to get ready for this podcast. And I realized I had to slow down because this is a savoring book. You're going on all these journeys and all these expeditions and all this history. And so I've really just been soaking it in and I'm excited to finish it. Beautifully illustrated, beautifully written. Thank you for the book, Ken, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much, Courtney. It's really a pleasure to talk with you.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
Put a stick on your soul. Yes, it does.